I wonder if there's any water. Oh, all right. The contents of my talk, and start with an introduction. And then I'll discuss the modified gravity action. Modified gravity is MOG, or Moffat gravity. I can't call it Moffat gravity, so I call it modified gravity. Field equations, modified Newtonian acceleration law, cosmology, MOG predictions. Thank you. Bullet cluster, enable 520, and draw conclusions. So the preferred standard model of cosmology today is the so-called lambda CDM model. As we know, the lambda is the cosmological constant, Einstein's cosmological constant. CDM stands for cold dark matter. And this model is very successful. However, it comes at a price, namely 96% of the energy and matter of the universe is invisible, not detected, possibly always invisible, and possibly never to be detected. This fact that 96% of the matter content in the universe is troublesome to me, possibly not to a lot of people. In fact, the consensus among cosmologists and physicists today is that dark matter exists. However, it's never been detected, and a great deal of effort's gone into detecting it. Eventually, it may be detected as a particle, and it has to be shown that this particle is stable and that it can successfully continue to fit all the data, extensive amount of data available. On the other hand, it may turn out to be the biggest and most expensive null experiment since the Michelson-Morley experiment. As we recall, most everybody in the smaller physics community in the late 19th century and all up to 1905 believed that ether existed. And effort was put into avoiding the consequences of the Michelson-Morley experiment, namely Hendrik Lorentz, Fitzgerald, and others attempted to explain the null experiment by keeping the ether. So, 1905, Einstein just didn't consider the ether at all, just ignored it. And we have special relativity and subsequently Einstein's general relativity. So, the fact we haven't detected dark matter is a strong incentive to seek alternative explanations that can account for all the available data without dark matter. So I started on this. This is because I'm intellectually curious about the universe, and I asked myself the question, can we construct a modified gravity theory which can do the job? And I've been pursuing this for quite some years now. So as we see, this the dark matter and dark energy is probably one of the most puzzling problems in modern physics and cosmology today. So the dark matter is cold and collisionless, particularly it's collisionless, and it amounts in the standard model to 25% of the overall budget of matter, and the dark energy is 76%. 70 some percent of the total amount of punishment. So, you infer the existence of dark matter and dark energy from the motion of visible matter in the gravitational field. And as I mentioned, is it possible to modify gravity to account for the data without dark matter? And the answer is yes, as we'll see. The equivalence principle and the metric in general relativity determine uniquely a four-dimensional space-time. And to modify GR, we either change the Einstein-Hilbert action, we introduce a pseudo-Riemannian geometry, which is modified, or we add new fields. Now, the new fields may be independently dynamical, dark matter, or they may be sourced by ordinary matter, so-called modified gravity. So, as mentioned, these are the basic constituents of the standard cosmology. We assume Einstein theory is correct everywhere, globally. We have a large-scale homogeneity in isotropy. As I mentioned, 5% ordinary matter, baryons and electrons, 25% dark matter, 70% dark energy. And we have a uniform cosmic microwave back radiation of about 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So, and we also find observationally that we have a scale-free adiabatic fluctuations. Delta T over T is about 10 to the minus 5. This is at the surface of light scattering, which occurs about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Now, first, let me discuss what a modified gravity has to do in order to be successful. It has to fit the solar system observations, which are very accurate, particularly for the inner planets, laser ranging, radar ranging, lunar laser ranging, and Ulrich experiments on Earth provide very accurate measurements, and Einstein gravity agrees with all of them very well. It has to predict and explain galaxy rotation curves, which don't agree with Einstein and Newton gravity unless you have a lot of dark matter. It has to successfully describe the mass profiles of X-ray clusters of galaxies. It has to explain the cosmic microwave background data, the CMB data, including the power spectrum data. It has to explain the formation of protogalaxies in the early universe and the growth of galaxies. It's got to succeed in explaining what are now a rather large amount of gravitational lensing for galaxies, clusters of galaxies. It has to account for the supernova data and the accelerating universe. It has to explain why we see the data we do for the bullet cluster, the famous bullet cluster, and potentially also the emerging cluster Abel 520. That's a large list. If at any time I fail to fit one of these items, I quit and do other physics, which I do, particle physics or whatever. I mean that, okay? It's been the case for the last 4 years. That is, if I can't fit this data without dark matter, then you quit. Okay. Got that straightened out. I'll get to that. This is a difficult problem, which I will discuss. I haven't mentioned made any comments yet about dark energy specifically, other than that we have to explain the data. Yeah. Right, you have to fit that data. If you accept it to be correct, you've got to account for the data. And the data seems to find that the universe is accelerated. But there are other models which say the universe is not accelerated. It's a murky issue, but I'll get to that. So the Axel Nerve model has been used successfully to account for galaxy cluster masses with the work of Chorfowski, who is sitting here. And we've published papers on fitting galaxy rotation curves, extensive data fitting published in the Astrophysical Journal. This was published in the Multinodular Astronomical Society. And recently, I've been collaborating with Victor Toth, and we have made progress on the theory and the reason why I'll explain. And Joel and I have also published in MNRES a paper successfully fitting the bullet cluster data without dark matter and so on. And recently, Victor Toth and I have succeeded in fitting most of the important cosmological data without dark matter. Okay, so let's look at modified gravity, this particular version. I call this is the simplest version by Occam's razor. And I call it STVG, and it involves scalar tensor and vector fields. And the action is given here. This is the usual Einstein-Hilbert action. This is a what's called a maximal Proker vector field action. So it's like the electromagnetic field, but it has a mass. And this is this S sub phi, the S sub S constitutes the action for the three remaining scalar fields. I make the theory as general as possible, and yet it's minimal. It's the minimal theory that can succeed in fitting all the data. We have the gravitational constant is a scalar field. We have the mass of the vector field, denoted by phi mu, is a varying scalar field. We have the coupling of the vector field to ordinary matter is a scalar field. So there are three scalar fields, one massive vector field, and Einstein-Hilbert with a pseudo-Riemannian metric. Sorry, what?
B mu.
B mu is it's the usual. It's like the match. So this describes what I just said. We assume the Einstein's cosmological constant is zero. And these are the potential momentum tensor for matter. And this is the vector current associated with the Maxwell-Proker field. This corresponds to coupling of the Maxwell-Proker to matter. Now for the moment, at the present, we're going to assume that the scalar field variation, the variation of the matter action with respect to the scalar fields is zero. Now, the first thing you learn when you try to modify Einstein gravity theory is that it's tough. Okay? Einstein produced this very robust theory in 1916. And trying to change it is very difficult, which is good because it means it doesn't open up many possibilities. Over the years, I refer to modified gravity theories that there's a graveyard, and in the graveyard there are these headstones for all the failed modified gravity theories. And there are many of them if you go through the list since 1916. The first thing you have to establish is that your theory is stable. It's free of ghosts and instabilities. And from my experience, years of experience working in this subject, almost all modified gravity theories fail on this count. They're unstable. They have unstable vacuum ground state. They have ghosts. And you're trying to compete with Albert Einstein, okay? So you've got to start with a theory that at least is reasonably respectable. It has to be self-consistent mathematically and has to be physically consistent. Otherwise, there's no point trying to fit data with it, because it's not going to work. Now, in my STVG, I can prove that it's stable, and this can be done using a Hamilton-Dirac constraint analysis. And it's a straightforward calculation. The basic results were published by Eisenberg and Nest in the Annals of Physics in 1977. There's effectively only one vector theory that couples to gravity without pathologies, instabilities, and that's Maxwell Proctor, as is proved in their paper in a very, very elegant way using Hamilton Dirac constraint analysis and Cauchy-Ignition variant development formalism. So this is why I use this theory. It's stable. Okay. Practically, yes. When I was first publishing modified gravity theory in my first paper was 1979, Physical Review, called The New Theory of Gravity, and a rather unsettled title, but anyway, there were maybe a couple of gravity theories that survived data fitting. Brandsteek, of course, is the Jordan Brandsteek is the standard example, which is stable. And a couple of others, and me. And it was a very unpopular pursuit at the time. It's still somewhat unpopular, but it's less unpopular now than it was then. In fact, almost everybody seems to be doing modified gravity these days. So that's the difference, okay? And I hate to say it, but most of the theories are not satisfactory. A lot of the work has to do with trying to explain dark energy. And of course, I'll get to that with Mark. There's only one rival theory which fits the data, namely Milgram. Milgram's original paper, 1983, produced the Milgram modifying Newtonian acceleration law, MOND, and was the attempt to make it relativistic went on for years. And Jacob Bekenstein finally published a paper in 1984 called Tevis, where he claims to have a relativistic theory of MOND. But that theory is unstable, has instability, severe instability. It's not difficult to prove this. Okay, so field equations are given here. When we assume that the gradients of the scalar fields, these three scalar fields, are zero, then we get Einstein-Hilbert plus Einstein's field equations plus the Maxwell-Proctor equations. And here is the vector field mass. So, in order to produce a theory at a fundamental level, a gravity theory, you have to succeed in getting a theory which has no adjustable free parameters, and so that it can predict something. Otherwise, you're just fitting data. So, over the last during the last half year with Victor Toth, we have succeeded in producing a model which is just that. It has no adjustable free parameters. And well, as we'll see how well it does. A theory succeeds by having a minimum number of assumptions and fitting the maximum amount of data. It particularly succeeds if it predicts something that no one has thought of before, and or no other theory can succeed in predicting. That is the ultimate success of the theory. People today working in theoretical physics have forgotten this, I think, but this is true. It always remains true. So I have to succeed in this mark exactly just that, but using a theory which is powerful enough to predict physics and produce results that agree with it. Okay, so if you do the variational spectra with phi mu, you get these field equations for the Maxwell proper field. For weak fields, which would be mainly concerned with weak fields, because all the applications tries to physics, cosmology, and astronomy are for weak fields. You end up solving this spherical symmetric static solution for the scalar part of the longitudinal part of the vector field, and we get this Yukawa solution directly, straight from the action principle. Then we have these extra field equations for the scalar field. Now it turns out remarkably that when you solve these extra field equations for g, mu, and omega, approximately, you determine everything. The only free parameter left is Newton's measure constant g, and what's called g sub infinity, which is, as I'll explain, the value of the varying gravitational constant at infinity, in particular super horizon in cosmology. Sorry.
The beta in phi zero r?
Beta is a constant integration. I'll explain it first.
So it's a parameter or you fix it to some value?
I'll explain. So I have to postulate an equation of motion, which may eventually come out of Mach, but at the moment it's postulated as a separate postulate. And when this Maxwell proper field is zero, you get the usual geodetic equation of GR. In that sense, the equivalence principle is satisfied, so to speak. The radial acceleration you get for weak fields is given here, and there's the beta, and it's always involved as a product with kappa and omega. Kappa is the ratio of the fifth force charge. We obviously have a new force here. It's a ratio of the fifth force test particle charge to the mass that comes in this form. And we set beta kappa omega to this, the beta be proportional to gm, and we get this acceleration block. And I denote alpha, so this is denoted by alpha, so y, and this is the range, the Yukawa range, which is 1 over mu. And that's it. Now, when you solve the
between the new charge and the mass, I didn't understand that.
Well,
you had that equation, beta kappa equals something or
yeah, the kappa that you find as a ratio of the fifth force test particle charge to the mass, which of course is approximately equal to the ratio of the source fifth force charge to mass. You find the energy of the particle spot.
But are you allowing it to vary from one kind of matter to another, or is it supposed to have the universal value, or?
Yeah, it doesn't. Fifth force source charge has to be a phenomenological, like Maxwell's theory. There's a charge distribution as a Maxwell's theory. The fifth force couples to it, as it turns out to barrier mass. So, what happens is that this is the alpha, and this is the mu from before. Here. And when you solve the field equations, approximately, you find that alpha and mu are determined to within two constants of integration, C1 prime and C2 prime, and G infinity. G infinity is fixed by the cosmology, as we'll see. So,
for alpha? Sorry, I didn't understand.
Sorry, what?
So, I'm missing something easy, but how do you get out?
Okay, you have to solve these field equations. Possible. And you solve them from G, omega, and mu.
Oh, so when you show them the next transparency?
I haven't given it detailed, I don't have time. But you do that, you find that you determine alpha and mu in the acceleration of alpha.
So here on this slide, this is just the nonsatz, right? Alpha.
This is an nonsatz.
It's some fitting formula, you're saying.
And then when you solve the field equations, you get a very tight knit into the theory.
But this is not actually a fitting formula. That wasn't chosen. If you can go back one slide, John. So in this equation, sorry, I still want to see G as a. Yeah, right.
Well, so far, these equations I recognize, right? This is just.
This comes out of the action principle.
Yeah, exactly. So these equations I all recognize, it's like you have an extra scalar median, you use alpha 4, that's precisely what you get. But the miracle to me is when you get alpha to be some complicated function of the mass. That's what I don't understand.
So there are two levels in the calculation. This also emerges from the action principle and was not encoded by hand as a fitting formula.
The second, the other expression.
And it.
Yeah,
alpha equals that. Where is it?
Yeah.
You have to solve it. The only way to see it is to do it actually, but it actually is correct. You determine alpha and mu in terms of two points of integration, into the integration. And you can fix, once you fix those two points of integration, C1 prime and C2 prime, then they have to, this formula has to work everywhere in the universe. Of all weak energies and fields, irrespective. This has to work for any bound, realized bound system, galaxies, globular clusters of galaxies. It has to work for cosmology.
Sorry if I insist, but to me this is the confusing point. So can you just at least sketch in the previous equation of motion, why you would get couplings that go as square root of the mass, because that's the crucial part.
Oh, because when you integrate the equations, you find that that n is proportional to r squared, which comes out from solving for the spherically symmetric solution. You solve the static spherically symmetric solution of the equations, the actions. You find that the mass So when you put this back in, this is what you get.
When I read the paper, I was also searching for where does the square root of the mass emerge.
Right.
And in fact, it really, it's gone out, but it does emerge from the calculation, the integration, and the square root of the m that appears here and here solves the differential equation. You can actually see how there's an integration constant.
If you take our paper, it takes you about an hour to do this. You don't even need Maple, you've got enough of calculus. It's that simple. It's absolutely remarkable.
Something that's squared, and you take the square root, and that's the moment where the square root of m actually appears and gets fed into the modified acceleration law, which is necessary to it.
How do you choose the sign?
Choose the what?
The sign.
Here's an example of what happens.
The square root.
Let's do cosmology. Okay.
The square.
It's square. Oh, it appears only a square. And then, this constant. Yeah. This is one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in my career. I couldn't believe it. But what's more incredible is that it actually fits all the data, as you can see. This is even more incredible. But this is necessary to have a theory. You're trying to compete with Einstein gravity. In 1916, he published it. In 1915, he took his field equation, r·u = 0, and solved for the Brillouin mass of Mercury. He plugged in the mass of the sun and the gravitational constant, and bingo, that came 43 arcseconds per century. And this is theory. This is the way you do physics. So he knew he was on the right track. I think now I'm on the right track because of what I'm about to present to you for similar reasons. Yeah.
So it seems that naively there is, so if I look at your acceleration law, there is no regime where A goes approximately like 1 over R, right? Because it's either 1 over R squared or it's dominated by the exponential suppression at large R.
Well, look, if you look at this formula, you see that when r goes to 0, you get by mu.
Yeah, that's right. So okay. The short distance reduces to Newton.
When r goes to infinity, you get back something I haven't written there, but you get back gn to 1 plus this.
If you were to plug that in square brackets, it would look like 1 up to a certain distance, and then at some distance, it would start to rise. And so that's why in galaxies you're able to fit the Newtonian core as if there's no modification. And up to maybe 3 or 4, up to 8 kiloparsecs, the square brackets, the second term, actually turn on. And that second term would completely dominate the, just like dark matter, outside the core.
I see.
So what happens is that you have to take this, you take this modified acceleration law with no arbitrary parameters. G Newton is a measured constant.
B and C are arbitrary.
These are integration constants. So we fix them by means of 52 couple of galaxies.
But they could be different for different galaxies.
Yeah, but it turns out they aren't.
But there is nothing
in your... Nor are they different when you fit clusters. Of globular clusters. I'll show you. That's the whole point.
But your theory doesn't predict that they should be the same for all the galaxies.
It says it's, they have to be the same for every realized gravity body in the universe.
But you just said they are integration constants.
Including the planet I'm standing on.
So if they are integration constants, there could be different solutions.
No, I think.
But I think it's
you integrate a set of differential equations, you get two constant integrations. This is standard. Okay. You probably apply some boundary condition in infinity. And that's it. Those are the constants that you use in.
Okay.
Okay, I have to move on. Cosmology. So we start by solving this scalar field equation for a big G and vector top. For large, you get an exact solution of this equation, keeping omega and mu fixed. This is an approximation. Otherwise, you have to solve a set of coupled equations, which is quite difficult. It can only be done numerically. But we make an approximation, as you always do in physics. It turns out if the approximation works, then you can believe in it. And the solution for large T, which we're interested in, is given here. So when you look at eta, A, the cosmic scale A is T to the eta, so H upper parameter eta over T. And when you solve for this, you find G is approximately constant. Then we solve for mu and so on, and we get finally, we solve for omega and mu. And K1 and K2 are fixed constants because of you're solving these differential equations. And you get, well, first of all, we adopt a FLRW, Friedman-Robertson-Walker line element, assuming an isotropic homogeneous universe. In that case, the spatial part of phi mu, the vector field, is zero, because you're not allowed to have any preferred directions in the space. And we adopt the fact that we've just shown that g dot is approximately zero, and you get this set of Friedman equations, which look familiar. And this is the conservation equation. And then you can solve for omega and mu, and you get this result, which turns out to be important, as we'll see shortly. So the massive vector field finally produces the density and pressure given here. And V phi, this is the self-interaction of the vector field phi, is the negative. So that rho phi can be positive, P phi negative. And then it turns out that when V phi dominates, we get a cosmological vacuum equation of state comes out from the action principle. Okay, I haven't made any assumptions yet. All comes from solving the field equation. And so we adopt the fact that omega sub phi, I call it, is lambda zero, by the way. Einstein cosmological theory. And this is the number we get, as we'll see, in order to fit the cosmological data. So Mach explains the supernova in an accelerating universe without dark matter within a unified model. The model gives a modified gravity and explanation for acceleration of the universe in all from one action principle.
It seems that instead of using the cosmological constant to play the role of dark energy, you have this ion field. I'm confused by that because although the matter content of the universe today is 72% dark energy, it wasn't always that way. The reason why the proportion of dark energy is increasing is because it isn't diluted the way radiation and matter is. And so this ion field, which is coupled to the density of baryons, how would it be diluted? Would it?
Well, because the raw matter behaves in the usual way. Little a is cosmic scale t to 2/3, so t to the 1/3, which is the 1/3 for radiation dominance, t to 2/3 for matter dominance. Of course, this is approximately constant. We can prove that, by the way. And therefore, the raw matter comes down and crosses the vacuum energy growth.
So you're treating this as vacuum energy and it simply doesn't
do it. It's just constant, so approximately constant back to the beginning of the universe. There are more interesting features which I don't have time to go into. By the way, from one of this package, we can immediately explain inflation because it comes out of the same action principle. But I don't want to get into that. Another talk.
Can you jump to the conclusion that since omega equals 1 today, the 72% of the universe is in the form of this ion field?
Yes. Vacuum. This is the vacuum part of the equation state. There's another equation state for mass, which is the usual one. So,
Are you going to tell us what V of phi is?
It's approximately constant. I don't need to tell what it is, because when you assume it dominates, then it dominates all the kinetic energy part. And you just find that P over rho is approximately minus 1. There are more subtleties, but I don't have time to go.
Sorry to interrupt, but let me ask my question earlier, but in a different way, right? So the equations of motion you showed earlier, they look pretty local, right? I mean,
they're all local equations.
Pardon me?
It's well.
They look naively local, right?
Well, this is a good question. Let me, if you're talking about locale, let me explain what this does. I'll get back to you.
Here's the question. If I put a lump of stuff and I go almost to infinity compared to this lump of stuff, then all the equations should linearize, at least if it's local. And if that happens, then I don't understand why the falloff of your law has some square root of m's floating around, like in the decay of the exponential. Because if everything is linear and they couple to the source, then all your fields should just be proportional to the mass.
No,
unless it's genuinely non-local.
Yeah, well, the point is that the field equations I saw to get the alpha mu, these are non-linear equations. That's the whole point. The miracle is that you solve these non-linear equations approximately and you get a particular alpha mu. So it's not strictly linear.
They stay nonlinear to infinity. So there's never a weak field regime, right?
Well, it's weak, but the fields are weak, but you still have this nonlinear set of equations. So that's the way it just comes out. You just crank the variational principle action, and you get this result.
Although you are right that if you take a limit and go to very, very large r, you simply get that capital phi is g infinity m over r. And so it looks very much like a Newtonian potential with a normalized g instead of low.
Right, so well, I agree, but what I'm worried about is not the first term. I worry about the second term, which is the exponential falloff. That looks like a massive scalar, which is falling off exponentially.
It is.
Normally, in the local theory, if I went to infinity, that would look like a massive scalar, and it would couple linearly. So everything there, mu would be a constant, alpha would be a constant. But here, they still know about the mass of the source. That's what's very
important. Well,
at least it's very nice.
Maybe this will answer your question. Because when I when I write that the Poisson equation, which I have to do with the small growth structure, then you get two pieces for the Poisson equation. You get the usual Newtonian piece, which is constant g infinity, of the Newtonian constant. And you get this thing here, which is non-local. So whenever you have a Yukawa potential in the theory, you're going to somehow end up with a Poisson equation with some non-local property.
Yeah, but if rho has compact support, it's pretty local, right? If it's just a local abnormal stuff.
Yeah, you have a non-local effect coming in here, which you don't have in the token. Anyway.
On larger scales, mass goes to infinity, so maybe then you don't have to worry about the square roots anymore, because the linearity that you're talking about is like m over a square root of m.
That's local, I agree.
So if mass goes to infinity, then that's fun.
That's right.
So then maybe that's why you don't have to worry about
it. But it appears in mu, I don't know.
When you go to infinity, you just get g infinity, you know? The power dependence pops out. It's only locally that you have power dependence of GRR. GRR is an effective gravitational constant.
Actually, when you look at the actual data, and you're integrating from the center of the galaxy to the edge of the visible data, it's rather sharp where the actual disk ends. And there comes a point where you have nothing left to integrate. And so at the outermost edge of the galaxy, you basically have an integrated mass inside the galaxy, and then the gas and the stars are so rarefied outside that they don't contribute any more to the H2O. And so as Justin was saying, you can work with the rho with compact support, and that's a good model for a real galaxy.
So mu is a constant of the theory, or actually, should we kind of vary it
from mu? Well, mu is a...
Yeah, it depends on the mass, mu.
Mu is a greater scalar field. Here I've kept it constant for the moment just to see what the Poisson equation looks like constant here, which you can do.
Actually, use a monotonically decreasing function there.
So G effective
looks like it kind of looks like an excitation that's peaked at the
center. I'm running out of time.
We've got a few minutes left.
Now, to estimate G, we know that for baryonic matter, rho m equals rho baryonic. So this is true of big baryonic synthesis. Of course, the g of r I have, which determines the nature of g, big g, is Newton's g for small r. So when you go to nuclear interactions through the big baryonic synthesis, you're using g mu to a high degree of accuracy. It comes out of the field. So we adopt the fact that we have G effective is 0.3 G infinity. G infinity left is 20 GN, and this gives you half of 19. So the simple explanation is that when you multiply G Newton by 7, you get 0.28, which is approximately 0.3. It just supports that G is increasing. The amount of gravity is increasing the amount of effect of the baryons. So we have this equation here. This is the matter. This replaces omega lambda in the lambda CDM model. We have a flat universe. Okay, now we have to determine the density profile delta in order to be able to calculate growth of structure, power spectrum, particular mass spectrum. And we use Einstein, Stein, and Hu, 1998. We tried using CMD FAST to do cosmology, but it's quite hopeless. As soon as you modify gravity, you can't use CMD FAST was constructed to to give you the Landesitian model. If you deviate from that model, you can't use lambda, you can't use CMP fast. We're actually working through the program line by line and changing it so someone can use it for this theory. But at the moment, we use semi-analytic methods to do the calculations. And this Eisenstein, who, as we know, works very well.
It's
semi-analytic, so we can do what we want. CMP-FAS is far from semi-analytic, it's far from analytic. It's just a numerical package put together by a lot of physicists. And some of them are lousy programmers, okay? So, fortunately, the people who constructed the model, the code are not sitting here, so I can see that. Anyway, we also use Mukhanov, Slava Mukhanov's semiotic CMP slow, published in his book of cosmology. And we put in these pieces here. And we'll see that we fit the acoustical power spectrum very well. His formula worked within 5-10%, which is good enough for what we're doing at present. The silk damping, which reduces, can erase the structure in the angular power spectrum, is reduced because K silk goes like G to the 3/4, and G is bigger by a factor of 7 or 10 compared to Newton. So the silk damping is reduced, and we don't erase the structure. That's simple. The effective G, the omega baryon doesn't depend on the effective G, because omega baryon only depends on the speed of sound, which depends on the baryonic matter density regardless of gravitation. These are all well-known facts. Okay, so we come to the Mach prediction. Now I repeat, we have no free adjustable parameters at this point. The cosmology parameters are all fixed. And the acceleration law, weak acceleration law for gravity is fixed. And we start going through the data. And everything follows from the action principle. There are no ad hoc phenomenological formulas. First of all, we start here in the solar system. We have alpha. This is alpha, alpha sub y, and this is lambda sub y. And this is all the data for checking Yukawa-like potentials in modified gravity. And this is all very accurate data. And alpha and y sub y, lambda sub y and alpha sub y, predicted to be well outside this. So there is no contradiction with the solar system data. This, from Mach's point of view, Einstein gravity fits very well the solar system data. Now this is predicted by the theory. So we got that part of the data in hand. Now we proceed to globular clusters in our galaxy. And again, we now have to take the Jeans equation and solve for the dispersion velocities of the randomly moving stars in the globular cluster. And we find that the theory predicts that Newtonian potential should work very well. The globular clusters at most about 10, 20 parsecs in size. And these are our predicted fits, and it works very well. These are two globular clusters, which are sitting on the outer edge of the galaxy, the Milky Way. And data is being obtained at present by the Bonn Astronomical Observatory in Germany. And we have a prediction here for the velocity sigma. This is a line of sight velocity dispersion from the Jeans equation. And this is Mond. Mond's prediction is not good. So here's a place where we can actually distinguish between Logan's Mond and this Mog. In order to get this to fit the data, what we predict and we think is probably correct is using Newtonian acceleration, which is predicted by Mond. then you need a mass to light ratio for the globular cluster of order 0.2, which is too small. It should be about 1 or 2. So here's a prediction that could be checked. Now we come to the galaxies. This is being produced by Joel, and is part of his doctoral thesis here at Waterloo University. And we take SDVG. This is a large galaxy, a high, so-called high surface brightness galaxy. And we put in the mass to light ratio, which is expected. We put in a mass into that acceleration formula, and we get this excellent fit to the data. This is the brown dashed line is the Newtonian prediction without dark matter, or the Einstein prediction, which obviously doesn't fit the data. This is the H1 gas, 21 centimeter line gas, and this line here is the stellar mass. Also again, get these fits. Mon, you can't distinguish Mon, Milton's Mon from Mon in these fits, it's very difficult. This is the Mon fit up here, sitting right inside our prediction. This is, Joel has calculated the result from a dark matter halo. And notice in a dark matter halo, you don't get the kinks in the data. You can never get the kinks in the data because the dark matter is collisionless. So we win over the actual appearance of the fitting.
Using the optical data to get this. And the dark matter profile, you're not using the optical data.
No. But dark matter dominates. So you don't see the outer edges. You don't of the galaxy, you don't see the you don't
so you
see
cannot that. Really plus if you don't see dark matter, you cannot really spot dark matter prediction.
Well, but the fact is that the fact is that we do get an excellent fit showing all the kinks.
So remarkably, the three curves that go through the data use parameters from those theories. And so
and optical data.
And the optical data they use is the Galaxy rotation curve, but the only best fit on that screen is actually the worst fitting result, which is a paradox in the sense that the NFW fit has two adjusted parameters, so the computer minimizes the least squares, and it calculates a very smooth profile.
But the NFW fit is not good for an individual profile, the dark. Okay, NFW fit is only for dark matter only simulations, which doesn't apply for systems that do have variance. And also it's an average of a lot of systems, not for...
You can't falsify dark matter.
So
I wouldn't pretend to do so.
It's interesting to check what are the predictions.
I'm not trying to falsify time.
Using dark matter in a galaxy.
Okay, so the other question, do you fit for B and C independently for each of these, or is it the same?
B and C are the same for all these.
For all of these, it's the same.
For anything.
I could make them adjustable, but the moment the computer treats them as numbers, and they're the same for every galaxy,
okay.
That I could allow to adjust.
This is a remarkable result.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Tommy Fisher law, Kepler's law is given here for circular velocity and radius r. Tommy Fisher says that the power of the circular velocity is proportional to mass, and that power of n is approximately 4, between 3 and 4. Now, when you solve our field equations from the action principle, we predict the Tommy Fisher law. As we find that the circular velocity squared goes like we have. Which is quite remarkable. Again, everything is coming out of the action principle. In dark matter, in the dark matter scenario, you have to put in the Tommy Fisher law by hand. But that doesn't falsify the dark matter. It's just not a nice thing to do. Occam's razor. This is data fitted by, published by Joel and myself. One of the best, world's best fits for the Tommy Fisher of his master beautiful journal. Yet now we get to clusters. We have to protect the Victorian mass profile of clusters. And this red dash is the data. This is mind. This curve here is mind, which doesn't fit the data. We all know that mind doesn't fit clusters without that, because this is being understood.
So what are the axis here?
The axis is
mass
in
the vertical.
It's a dynamic mass versus radius in kilograms. And the fits are excellent. Predictions are excellent. Now we get to satellite galaxies. These are satellite galaxies orbiting host galaxies. And this big dark blue curve is Mach's prediction from the change equation for the velocity dispersion. No adjustable parameters again, same C1 prime and C2 prime. And this is data got by Prada and Clifton, 2007. This is Newton, and the direct dash curve is Mond, which is too flat. We'll even assume an isotropic genes equation. You can put in an isotropic, and you can get a better fit with Mond, and you can also improve our fits, but this is the simplest minimal fit to the prediction to the data. Supernova data. This is the magnitude of supernova, absolute luminosity versus redshift. The blue curve is lambda CDN and Mach predictions are the same. Can't distinguish them at present. This is Einstein de Sitter, the red dash curve. This is a pedagogical picture. This is Q, the deceleration parameter is 0.05. Instead of Einstein de Sitter, which is half 0.5. And the blue curve is Mach lambda CDM. And you can see that the difference between the two is tiny. So the data simply isn't good enough to distinguish a small q from Einstein from lambda CDM with a W of minus 1 equal to minus 1. Equations stay equal to minus 1. This is the acoustical power spectrum fit from Mach. No adjustable parameters. Now using Mukhanov. Excellent. No dark matter. Now we get to an interesting thing. We now have to calculate the matter power spectrum. This is the power spectrum based on a statistical distribution of galaxies in the sky. And from the transfer function, we have T equal to T baryon plus T CDM. And you can show that T baryon from perturbation calculations is proportional to the Bessel function, whereas this is smooth because the dark matter particles are collisionless. So if you have only baryons, then you get these unit oscillations occurring. And for this dotted line here is the Einstein with only baryons. It's hopeless, of course. When you use Mach without adjustable parameters, you see the wiggles are sitting along the data right there. This is the lambda CDM. So we have to put in a window function because you have to bin the data. So you simulate a binning of the predicted results. So straightforward, and you get this remarkable result. The power spectrum, this is Mach. This is the red curve. The lambda CDM curve is the roughly smooth curve from collision to dark matter. Within about 3 years, I'm told by the observationists, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey makes we should have enough galaxies to distinguish between this wigglies, the oscillating small amount of CDM. If you as you increase, if you decrease the width of the window function to a delta function, then these oscillations are going to be more pronounced, whereas lambda CDM will still be smooth, roughly smooth. So there it is. We can actually distinguish definitively between dark matter and modified gravity. Because for dark matter, you get this relatively smooth curve. For the MOM, the oscillations will increase as you increase the accuracy of the data and decrease the width of the window function. And in 3 or 4 years' time, I'm told, we should be able to tell whether MOM is correct, modified gravity is correct, or dark matter is correct. To me, that's quite a dramatic result. I never suspected that I would be able to get. I'm running out of a lot of time, so I have a few more slides. Maybe after. Is that all right? This curve, this represents the, you take the transfer function, you square it up, put in some factors, and you get the power spectrum. It's the matter power spectrum. It's a matter power spectrum. It comes from counting galaxies, statistically. It's not the acoustical power spectrum. That's called the angular power spectrum. This is the matter power spectrum. Yeah, that's right. It's three-dimensional. The data comes from Tech, Max Tech Market, our physical review. Okay. So now we arrive at the following fact, that we have this relationship, mu squared times n equals a constant. Mu is the mass of the Phion, I call it the Phion vector field. So when you plot the log of the mass of any bound realized object in the universe versus the log of R naught is another notation for the inverse of mu, then we get this line here. You see, it goes like R squared, R naught squared. And this is what we get from our fitting. The galaxy clusters will come in on that line with the new predictions. This is all the work. The galaxies will come in on close to that line, so will dwarf galaxies, and the satellite galaxies sit on the line, the globular clusters sit on the line, and of course the solar system sits on the line. So we're fitting, remarkably fitting, astronomical, astrophysical, cosmological data over 22 orders of magnitude in mass. The bullet cluster. Give me 5 more minutes. Is that all right? There have been a lot of questions, which I can understand. But it's, okay, now, in August 2006, NASA put out a press release saying that with the publication of the bullet cluster data, dark matter had been proved to exist beyond any doubt, which gave me food for thought at the time. And so I sat down and worked out all the lensing formulas for more in detail. I hadn't completely done that yet at that time. And I put out a preprint about 2 or 3 weeks later, pointing out that we should hold on here because the issue is not settled yet, and we'll see why. So, Joe and I published an extensive paper in the Multinodular Royal Astronomical Society last November with an associated press release by the Royal Astronomical Society, which exactly cancelled out the press release of NASA. We were not responsible for this, the Royal Astronomical Society was responsible for it. This caused a lot of blogging. You go to the blog sites, there are hundreds of comments about this, and, back and forward. Okay, there it is, famous picture. And you know how it works. The two clusters collide. This is the plasma, the hot plasma, which exists in clusters, X-ray plasma. It's the red. This is an animated picture, of course. the blue represents the dark matter, which is collisionless, so it just goes right through without collision, and the galaxies go right through without collision because galaxies are far enough apart, they don't collide particularly in their collision. This is the proof of dark matter. So, so this is a description of what we did, Joel and I, and it's naturally it's an extensive fitting of all their data, which they kindly gave to us. Douglas Clough, who heads the Bullet Cluster team, gave us all the data. And these are the basic formulas for lensing. You, by the way, you need a relativistic theory to do lensing. And Mach is a fully relativistic theory. There's never any violation of relativity in Mach at any time, which is not true of Bekenstein's tethers, for example. Bekenstein's tethers, you violate local Lorentz invariance. It's built into the action principle. So one can discuss whether you like that or not, but that's the way it is. So that what you get, what's called a convergence lensing, kappa, is two-dimensional, and it comes from integrating over the density of the clusters, and you get this formula here, famous formula, sigma bar of xy over sigma c, where sigma c is this constant. Normally it's a constant Einstein gravity, and these are distances from us to the lensing, and from lensing to the source, and so on. So normally g comes outside to calculate the lensing, becomes g Newton. But here, of course, we have an effective g, which is predicted, no arbitrary constant, and you put it inside and do the integrations. You get the kappa lensing. That's how it works. And here's, I did a two-dimensional cartoon picture of what happens, a one-dimensional cartoon picture. This is a sketch of what actually how it works. You can do this, and it's a one-page maple code. You can do it yourselves when you get home. I constructed a model for the surface density, sigma, capital sigma, and it's proportional to one of the parameters that goes in is the density of the matter. And I calculate g of r with a center r chosen. So red curve is x-ray gas, sigma. Blue curve is g of r over r, dividing a constant. And the green curve is what's predicted. There it is. These are the two lobes, the blue lobes that you saw in the picture. It's very simple. It's absolutely amazingly simple. Now, in this simple cartoon, I took G outside instead of integrating over it, but essentially it's the same feature. So these are pictures, and this is results from our paper, Joel and myself. I assume that you can, it's a very crude thing, but it just gives the, when you do the integral with G inside, you get the same result as the cartoon picture. It's just to give you a physical picture of what's going on. Otherwise, it's difficult to understand what's happening, because the calculations in our paper are fairly complicated. Now, we get to Abel minus 0, and I'm almost finished. This is almost exactly 1 year after the PET publication of the Bullet Cluster data and the NASA press release. There was a paper published by the Victoria, BC Astronomy Group, headed by Madhavi and Hoekstra, and also Caltech was involved. And they used the France, Canada, Hawaii Super Optical Telescope observations, and they get what's called the train wreck. This is another two colliding clusters. Okay. However, the results for this are exactly the opposite for the Bullet Cluster, because now, in the animated picture, the dark matter never left the plasma, the baryons. It stuck with them. Okay? And also down here, here we see a picture, the dark matter sitting inside the dark plasma. And here they have the observed galaxies, clusters of galaxies. And they established that these galaxies do not have any dark matter. The mass to light ratio is quite low. So now we have two opposite conclusions from the bullet cluster. In the standard model of dark matter, dark matter particles do not collide with anything, including themselves, or very little. Okay? And galaxies have dark matter halos. Here, the galaxies do not have any dark matter halos, and the dark matter has not separated from the baryons. It's interacting with the baryons in order to get it gets stuck in the middle when the two clusters collide. This is a serious problem for dark matter. It could be, since I'm standing in this city, it could be the Waterloo of dark matter, another Waterloo. Okay? And there have already been attempts to explain this. One explanation would be that the dark matter doesn't. There are two kinds of dark matter. One interacts with baryons, and the other kind doesn't. And the ones in the galaxies don't interact with baryons, and the ones here do. Now, nobody likes this for obvious reasons. The other issue about the galaxies not having dark matter halos is that they have what's called a slingshot effect. The galaxies are tossed out from in here without and lose their dark matter. It's stripped off. Well, it's possible. Now, what about Mong? Well, from my intuitive looking at it with using back of envelopes, I can see how Mong can fit this data. Because I don't care about the dark matter of galaxies, because there isn't any dark matter. Now, I don't have to separate any dark matter from baryons, because it doesn't exist in this particular scenario. So we're working on this. Conclusions. I'm already almost 20 minutes old. So we demonstrated these results, the predictions, directly from the modified gravity action principle, without resorting to ad hoc assumptions. After we fixed two integration constants from observation, no free adjustable parameters remain in the theory to make definite predictions. Universals shouldn't be used to the integration constant and integration constant, but they become, so to speak, the numbers once fitted become universal. So we've established through all this work that we can fit the universe starting from the solar system out to the horizon of cosmology over 22 orders of magnitude in mass without adjustable parameters, all coming from the action principle. So this theory has a possibility of really making predictions that can be verified. One aspect that we've looked into is the Max principle. Whenever you modify gravity theory, you do not get Dirkhoff's theorem, you don't get Gauss's law, you don't get a 1 over r squared potential. So there's a possibility, we have a paper on this, that we can actually explain the origin of inertia and the meaning of inertial frames of reference. Also, I have a paper on a four-dimensional description of the beginning of the universe, which is non-singular, involves this mark to some extent, and never violates the second law of thermodynamics, which I consider rather cherished secret. Thank you.
I know that people were going to have questions, but I want to let people who need to leave go. So thanks for coming. But we're going to have a question for you now.
So you said that you have this you have something that acts like a cosmological constant, which tracks the, which stays roughly the same density as matter. I don't know much about it, but I thought there were these things called tracking models where there was such a cosmological constant, and they fell afoul of nucleosynthesis predictions. Can you comment on that? Like, how? So the question, I suppose, is how would this deal with if you have something that's acting like a cosmological constant, and it would be, you know, it has the same density as matter. How would that square with nucleosynthesis?
Well, nucleosynthesis calculation, of course, nucleophysics calculations. So if you have a variable g, for example, here, for example, then the theory predicts that for small distances, which are very small for nuclear physics, you get g in Newton, which is trivial. And you get big bang nuclear synthesis. As for the cosmological constant, the effects at, if you draw density versus some rock versus T, then the raw map comes down like this, and the omega phi is like that. So we cross 9 billion years. It's called the coincidence problem. We hope to be able to predict why it is that we're not there yet.
So, John?
And so, down here, at the time of the DPN, the so-called cosmological constant is not important.
But, so, when is the phi field source?
Sorry?
When is the phi field, what epoch is that phi field sourced?
Well, present, it's always there, like the cosmological.
I know, not present, sourced. No. It has to be.
What source is it?
It's sourced by baryons, you
claim. Everything is sourced by.
But, right. So, what epoch, if it's uniform in space, right? If it's a cosmological constant, with omega equals, with w equals
yeah.
minus
1. It's approximately.
So, when are we supposed to picture it being sourced, and how come it's not interacting with matter at any subsequent epoch?
Well, it turns out that when we solve these non-linear differential equations,
is it possible that it couples to somehow the trace of mu mu? So it starts your phi becomes somehow important when at baryon radiation equality, right? Something like that.
I guess is it only becomes important at the moment when the structure starts to form.
There are always baryons.
Even in a homogeneous cosmology,
in the case of a homogeneous cosmology,
your baryon numbers
get the same everywhere.
You always have 5% baryon. Omega p is an order.
But it's only 0.5% now. It was much higher earlier.
So omega m is 7 times omega baryon.
Right.
That's more than 0.3.
Right. You said it, but I don't understand. This has nothing to do with phi. What's acting like dark energy today?
Right.
That was sourced when? At what epoch? What time? When was it? So the phi field gained the vacuum excitation value. It went to the minimum of its potential. Right. Or the maximum.
Well, okay. So
was it there always? Or
no. Don't phi minus.
No, but
it could be there before BDN.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. I mean, if it's always where it is, if it's always a cosmological, the cosmological constant fits fine for BDN because it was so fast as a dominant at that epoch. It's very early.
Right, but a cosmological constant doesn't change Newton's constant. And when you do the calculation for BBN, you find that Newton's constant had to be very, very close to its bare value today at the moment of BBN.
Right, so
in this scenario.
So phi is related to the cosmological value of Newton's constant, which is different from the Newton's value.
Also true.
So the solar system value and is.
Okay. So the only thing that makes sense to me is if this omega phi starts becoming relevant when baryons, the energy density in baryons is comparable to that in radiation. That's the only special epoch in your story, right?
It has to do with the size of the self-interaction potential.
Right.
The phi effectively.
Right.
When that dominates, you get W phi equal to minus 1, approximately. Very close to minus 1, depending on what we choose for this scale.
Right, but you have to source it initially somehow.
Well, source by baryons.
I know, but what?
By baryons all the time.
I know, but then why? So is, so is it being sourced locally in the Earth and therefore at a greater value than in the background?
But that, see, there are two different questions, right? The background and the excitation. The excitations are sourced by matter. But the background is considered electrical transfer constant. So, I mean, I don't think really it's really addressing the cosmological constant problem. You're just looking at constant.
No, no, it doesn't solve the cosmological constant. Why is lambda zero? Well, that's another talk I
have. But also, but you have to find, but you have to tune this, but you have to self-tune this. It's just like quintessence.
Yeah. But it comes out of the action principle.
But where is the quintessence? There's some small parameter that you put in there. Yeah.
Right. You have to fix.
Where does that number get in here? That's what
that's
people
what
are asking.
Yeah, I don't know. Or, yeah, that's what I want to know. It's like, where does
it comes
that
in from V of phi. V of phi is, I don't know, it's what lambda phi is for. There's no scale. Phi I is here.
So it's not it's just a parameter you put in.
So what is lambda?
So I mean, it's just it's just it can just be quintessence. It's fine. It's just but it's not. I mean, you had to put some other parameter in the.
You have your lambda. Your V dominates. I don't know. The lambda is fixed, so that you get the right answer.
So is lambda an artificially small
omega phi?
Is lambda a very small number or a very large?
This is one part. Whenever I talk about just parameters. I'm talking about the dot method part that never needs a adjustable parameter. When it comes to the dot energy, then we have an adjustable parameter as usual to get this number.
So it's in lambda, is that the answer?
Yeah, it's in a constant to do with it.
So this lambda, is this lambda?
I don't want to use this as a model. These are phi is a function of some parameter lambda. Coupling constant, self-interaction.
So is this lambda dimensionless? I can't see. But this phi is not a scalar field, it's a...
No, phi naught has dimensions, one of the root big G from the action principle. So you just figure out what the dimensions are.
So is there a sense in which the lambda suitably made dimensionless is a very small or a very large number in order to fit the dark, quote-unquote, dark energy?
The prediction for all the absence of dark matter, all the galaxies and the clusters, whatever. That is fixed without done without arbitrary parameters, just for parameters. The dark energy, we're not there yet. We're working on it. Right. See if there's some way of getting the non-linear equations to determine what this is numerically. There seems to be some possibility of this. During the last few weeks.
But you showed it fits. I don't understand. You showed it fits with a supernova data.
Yeah.
It's the same as lambda
CDM.
This is just like lambda.
By the way, I forgot. I didn't have time. I have my foot in another camp. I published 3 papers, JCAP, in which I use an inhomogeneous solution, exact solution of Einstein's field equation. Without modified gravity. And I claim in that paper that with a void, I can fit the supernova data, explain the acceleration of the universe without any dark energy and without. There is no acceleration. Acceleration is just apparent. And I put a lot of work into that. There are a lot of long papers. And then cited. So, paper just came out recently, 2 of them, claiming that you can use. These are so-called metrotonal bonding models to fit the supernova data, acceleration data, and fit all the CMB data. the acoustical power spectrum of anger and so on. I haven't checked it, but that's very interesting. It came out a few days ago. So, the dark energy thing is very innocuous. Yes?
Is there more questions?
Well, I just wanted to, did I understand correctly when you said that the equation of motion for a test particle has to be put in by hand?
Yes.
But that's, now I'm puzzled because generally when you have nonlinear field equations, there's a problem of consistency. Every theory of gravity, modified or unmodified, the equation of motion of the test particles is a theorem.
Well,
how do we know that we're consistent here?
Actually, this problem was the front set of my PhD thesis at Cambridge in the year which I will tell you about. So I sweated over this problem. But, I worked out all of Einstein info and all this horrible calculations, and also a paper by Einstein info back in 1949. I discovered it was wrong. Anyway, so here I know how to get the equation of motion I have from the field equation. I can do it. I know how to do it. And so they can come out of the nonlinear field. But I haven't. To me, that's not so important at the moment. This is icing on the cake. The issue is, can you get a theory which is free of parameters as far as the dark matter is concerned and fit all the data? So I'll get to that at some point. But yeah, that's a good point. This is not going to be a separate process. Yeah. Everything should come out of the actions, and it will.
I mean, I was just, if I could just ask also, I was surprised when you said that the Fechenstein theory violates local Lorentz covariance.
Yeah.
I don't see that. It has the strong equivalence principle built in.
The reason is that I don't like waiting in other people's parties. People have to judge these theories on their own merits themselves. Since you asked the question, in the Fechenstein Lagrangian, he has a term lambda linear square plus one. He needs this because without it, in his tennis and mod, you can't get enough bending of light. Light bending is the same as a GR. Of course, therefore you can't fit all the lensing data, huge amounts of lensing data. So this is back. So you put this in, there's a long history behind this. It took Fechenstein, it took them almost 25 years, a quarter century, to arrive at this theory. And I admire these people because they were doing this long before I turned up doing it. It took a lot of tenacity because people complain about it constantly. Mon is like a football, a kicker all the time. So, you look at this, this is a Lagrange multiplier, this is the vector comes into the action. So when you vary lambda, you get a mu squared equals minus 1. So a naught, a mu is equal to components, plus 1, 0, 0, 0. It's like a preferred frame theory. But now the problem is that, yeah, because he's only, in GR there isn't a preferred frame. This violates local Lorentz covariance. These are called ether theories.
I think what Harvey is saying, if I'm still in this theory, all the matter fields coupled to a single metric. So,
no,
it's coordinates where
the theory is generally covariant. Harvey. Sorry. The theory is generally covariant. But it violates local Lorentz.
He has, I mean, the matter fields couple in the usual way, not to the G metric, the G tilde metric. Mm-hmm. That's irrelevant for present purposes. Everything is locally for the matter fields. The dynamics of the matter fields is locally Lorentz invariant.
Yeah, but you have to put this into the action principle. And therefore, you end up with a preferred. People doing this agree. I mean, I think there's a general consensus.
Isn't this just a linguistic issue? Yeah. I mean, you have a phi mu, which has a non-zero value.
It never violates.
So it also picks out a local frame.
No.
It's just a question that it's a No. Even in yours, it's a constant integration, so to speak. It could have been zero, whereas in this, it could not be zero.
No, no.
But in practice, you both have a non-zero vector field.
There's another preferred frame in my theory source. This is fixed into the axis.
You have a sneaky.
You both have a, don't you have a scalar, a vector field with a non-zero value?
V of phi is a self-interaction potential.
But don't you have a phi mu?
Constantly becomes
a vector field.
A vector field.
Does a vector field have a
no, not necessarily.
Is it non-zero?
If you get a vector field.
I thought the dark energy was supposed to be.
If you give a vector field a vet, you violate a reciprocity. I was one of the first to do this.
So
it
doesn't have a
1990.
So what is it average? So now it's zero?
I don't.
So yeah. The vector, so your vector field has a zero value.
Why are not the vector finally a zero?
The value is zero.
Why should it be zero?
Why is it fixed? I mean, how does it fix to zero?
Well, you don't have a false vacuum.
I thought you said it was contributing to quote unquote dark energy. Maybe yeah. I didn't understand.
If it comes out
well, if it's contributing, it can't be zero then.
Well, I call it vacuum energy because it's because it's obvious minus one, but I don't actually need to say the phi is a vacuum
expansion. But I mean, is the current value, never mind it's vacuum, whatever that means, is the current cosmological value of phi zero or not zero?
It's not. It's right there. Mm-hmm. The equation's right there.
Yeah. So it also selects.
It's time-like, just like that.
Yeah.
Even though I mean,
the only difference is that in your theory it could be zero.
Radius theory. You're saying this force is a dynamical setting of a preferred.
Yeah, it's dynamically chosen.
Yeah, but it's not the same as this because here you find a local orientation for everything, all the matter, everything. That's right.
You're saying the coupling is different, is that? Yeah.
For anything that you do, you have to have this condition.
Yeah.
Anything, not just dark energy.
Yeah, it's not.
By the way, this also causes problems, because if you do a Hamilton direct constraint analysis in this action, you can do it in two or three pages. Lee has these small stuff. It's not straightforward. You find that when you do to Hamilton direct constraint analysis following the methods of direct versus second class constraints, then the Hamiltonians are bounded from below, which is a straightforward proof. There's a paper by Michael Seifert who was here giving a talk. He works with Robert Wong at U of Chicago, and he has gone through all this because this is the case. My former graduate student, Michael Clayton, proved this in 2000.
Can I follow up on Harvey's question?
Yeah.
So this is really my puzzle. If the equations of motion for the test particle can be derived from your action, what really trips me off is that the force law you get gives you an extra, so the extra force on a test particle falls up exponentially at large distances. So you go arbitrarily far, or equivalently you let the mass of the test of the source mass to go to zero, and you know, you get an arbitrarily, you know, epsilon small force, right? So in that limit, you would expect all your equations linearize. If they don't, then there's some intrinsic non-locality, like in Mon. So in Mon, indeed, at very small gradients, non-linearities become more and more important. On the other hand, Mon doesn't give you asymptotically flat solutions.
Right.
You have a logarithmic divergence in the extra potential.
So you can have it both ways. Extra force falls off to epsilon at large distances. In fact,
in your case, it does, right?
Extra force dominates.
Your extra force goes exponentially.
There's
minus
one
R.
Plus that you missed in there. So there's a one plus inside the exponential. So at large distances,
it goes at 1/r² then, or whatever. Or does it go?
So you factor out that. You find that at large distances, the Yukawa term is dominating over the Newtonian term at large distances.
So it goes as 1/r, you're saying, like
yeah,
for a while.
Right, so eventually this...
I guess the question is, does it go asymptotically flat or not?
So the way to return back to the one over r squared behavior isn't by allowing you Kawa term to go to epsilon, but it eventually itself looks like a one over r squared term. But at all times of length,
let me understand that. So, okay, are you saying there? Okay, it's true, the limit of large r, the exponential goes away, but I'm left over with some renormalization
of g. There's a 1 plus inside the u comma.
It goes as, it goes as 1 over r squared.
Right. So even though the exponential is suppressed, the Yukawa term is everything.
Okay, I misspoke, but let's just take that for granted. So thanks for correcting me. But then if I look at that, I see that the extra force goes as 1 over r squared. So it's not like mod, it's something that really dies off at infinity, and it gives you asymptotically flat solution. So this says, very, very crudely speaking, naively, that indeed at the arbitrarily far distances, you recover, an arbitrarily small extra force from.
No, actually, the difference is at small distances, you get gn m over r squared, and at large distances, you get g infinity m over r squared. And the ratio of g infinity to gn can be hundreds and hundreds of percent. And so at large distances, it looks like a 1 over r squared, but g is much smaller.
Let me say this differently. Let me say it differently. Let's suppose I'm letting m go to 0, okay? Okay, so let's not take r to infinity. Let's take m go to 0. And so b is a constant. So as m goes to 0, the exponential for fixed r dies off. The extra contribution goes to 0 compared to Newtonian contribution. Right, so this says that arbitrarily small test mass, at arbitrarily small source mass, at fixed distance from it, I'm getting an epsilon difference compared to Newtonian gravity. Right. And I still don't understand why in that limit your equation is non-linearized, or why there's still non-linear dependence on m.
I've never thought of that limit.
In the limit that mass goes to 0?
Yes, I put a source mass, I can go either arbitrarily far from it, or I can take its mass to 0. So let me do that. Let me take big M to 0. And then, because this is the crucial thing, right? In that limit, I would expect all your equations linearized, because the extra force is becoming, exponentially tiny compared to Newtonian gravity. So if they linearize, then I don't see how these nonlinear dependence on m survives in that limit.
But it doesn't. It goes to 0.
In that limit. It goes to 0 as m squared.
That's right.
So it's nonlinear. So the nonlinearity of the extra component survives for arbitrarily small tests.
What you're saying is that it's going to be like epsilon times
m squared.
Times m squared,
so,
right?
You never get that from a linear theory.
Z goes to 0. R squared times 1 plus 0.
Z goes to 0.
Let me make my statement more precise. Maybe it's a wrong statement. The statement is, there's two statements. Let's just focus on the extra contribution compared to Newton. I'm taking a particular limit where that extra contribution becomes tiny.
Okay. Like in the sources.
Yeah, again. I don't care. Let's make it extremely tiny as you want. Then in that limit, if your system of equations is somehow local and some at some level, you expect that they will linearize, right? Unless they have some very screwed up behavior at very small gradients. But if it's a normal local theory, it will linearize. But if it linearizes, then that extra contribution should never depend on some nonlinear power of the source. Because it's linear, right? I mean, it means...
I don't know. If you look at the equations, at some point, you might have something that looks like squares, and you can always take a square root of an entire equation.
Yeah, but if it's squared, then it's non-linear. So either you cannot have it both ways. Either your equations are non-local, in which case somehow you cannot linearize them about small values, or
okay. Yeah, it's just like arguing that there's a cosine in your result and saying that the cosine can't be there because everything has to be.
Yes, exactly. A cosine, that small value of its argument becomes linear.
So
it becomes constant.
So I have an answer for that. Those constants of integration, they could be constants of mass.
How can that be if the theory is linear?
The constant of integration are not predicted by the theory, they're just predicted by hand. So
that's another, if you're putting by hand a constant that depends on the mass by hand, then Harvey's point is valid. You're not deriving this fully from the action principle.
That was my point originally. Those are constants of integration that are not predicted by your action principle. So in principle, different spherical solutions could have different constant of integration.
But look, it's just an example.
No, not initial conditions. No, they're just constant integration. You could have different solutions to different constant integration in different parts of the universe. The fact that they are not different, that's interesting. But that's not predicted by the theory.
But why is it that normally you just set the values of some scales at infinity and that
if you take the energy of GR and integrate the differential equations, one of the differential equations, and you impose the Kalski space to infinity, you get G naught log equal 1 plus C over half. C is a constant of integration. Now what is C? Well, the theory has to give Newtonian gravity. So G naught log is equal to G naught minus 1 divided by 2 is pi. And from pi, we know that this C I had has to be Gn. Out comes the Schwarzschild solution, because the constant integration has to be true everywhere for everything. Same here.
Well, that's we define that as abnormal. That's really our definition of abnormal for the Schwarzschild solution.
Yeah, we fix the constant integration by observations. The way you do the Schwarzschild solution.
And
but if the source is a star or something, then it's not free. You don't have a free constant integration.
Right.
You need to know the mass density of the star, and that gives you the value of this constant of integration.
Yeah, but when you integrate differential equations, you get constants of integration.
Yeah. But in this case, there's no new free constant of integration.
There's no
in the normal case, there's no new free constant of integration. Once you specify the mass density, the only constant of integration is zero, and you say that the potential goes to zero at infinity.
There are usually two constants.
That's a sort of universal thing for all the systems. It should be.
You have to impose a boundary
zero.
And in case of Schwarzschild solution, you impose the Minkowski, and that reduces one of the that puts one of the constants to zero. And you left them off as C over R.
Yeah, because there are many Schwarzschild solutions. There's a whole one parameter set of them, different mass black holes. But if the source is matter,
then
there's no form of
reason. You then go to the matter distribution, then you solve those differential equations.
Well, I guess maybe another way of putting this question is that if you have two sources, then would the solution be approximately a superpositional?
Yeah, because it's like a spatial solution. Mm-hmm. You can't add the solutions together.
No, with separate sensors. Yeah. Distant sensors.
Well, if you take them far enough away, then you get back new.
But how about those costs?
With a G infinity, I get back large enough R. You get A comes into minus G infinity A over R squared. That's what I get. The G infinity is equal to G nu into 1 plus a constant. This is a constant.
But that's the same constant for all the different.
Yes, same.
If you put two together, it's still the same constant.
That's right. And the main thing is that it has to fit all the data. And if it doesn't, then you just throw this thing away. And it turns out it does fit all the data. I mean, the galaxy fits are really absolutely remarkable. And in Mond, the Mond has one free parameter. A naught for the whole universe. You could still have one adjustable parameter. And the latest paper, Bekenstein is varying it now to try to get around the fact that he needs double delta for pluses. By the way, he's also.
Can I interrupt? So, yeah, so that question is precisely the. I like the way you phrased it. I like the way you phrased it because if you take two, another way to say it is you take two sources. And you ask what's the extra force between them for arbitrarily small sources. And your theory predicts that that force will be nonlinear in the mass of these. I can't just superimpose the field of this guy plus the field of that guy. Right? Maybe I'm missing. That's what I'm
thinking.
Far apart? Yeah, super far apart, you know. And then they're the only thing in the world and they have mass. Well, you know, you had an m squared piece that doesn't.
Because epsilon times
yeah,
m squared.
It's 1 plus epsilon is tiny, which you can ignore.
But the fact that it's tiny isn't what's relevant. The fact that it is proportional to m squared is what's relevant. It's not going linearly to zero.
But some polynomial m would still have superposition, wouldn't it? It's just a new effect of mass for distance. For distant field, for long range field. Such as a renormalized mass. So it could still happen that force is superimposed.
A very large
distance gives you.
That's just right. If one guy, the field of one guy goes as the mass square of this guy, and I put this particle here, I'll get, you say, the force will be the mass of this guy times the mass square of that guy.
Justin, the point is that here we don't have Birkhoff's theorem, we don't have Dobson's law. It's not the matter in the rest of the universe is going to affect what happens inside a spherical shell. This is true of this theory, it's not the same as GR. So there is a non-local effect on matter, there has to be.
Of course, we ignore that when we actually do the odds here.
Well, the reason you can do that is because in a paper we showed that what we from our cosmology fits. When we determine the matter and the rest of the universe from the cosmology, it turns out there's a tiny effect on what happens in the solar system or globular cluster account. We can show this. If you can't do that, then you're dead because it means that you have to take into account all the rest of the matter in the universe in order to do a calculation. This is not a healthy thing. You have to show that it's not consistent with the rest of the matter in the universe. And we've done that. It's a paper on the archive.
The remarkable thing about your question is that the actual data is inside the computer in the form of a sigma map, which means that the surface is divided into pixels, and each pixel is a very, very tiny mass compared to the entire mass of the whole galaxy. And when you're at some distance from the center, it basically looks back at all of those pixels and treats them as all as epsilon and calculates the mass enclosed. So it's interesting that your question is related to the nonlinearity of each of those elements of the mass of the galaxy. But in fact, that's actually what it does. It looks back at the galaxy as a bunch of small masses and adds them together and calculates the acceleration at a certain distance. But in all these things, the Yukawa term, if you're trying to create a real galaxy, then you know that if you're going to replace dark matter, this second term, the Yukawa term, isn't just a small add-on, but it actually has to be the dominant source of gravity in a real galaxy by a factor of 6 to 10. Simply because it's attempting to replace the dark matter.
Sure.
And so all those little epsilon masses have to create the normally Newtonian potential that you get, which doesn't fit the galaxy, plus an extra contribution which actually dominates. And so one of the things I did plot, just out of interest, is I plotted the Newtonian potential as a function of r, and then I could separate out the Newtonian potential to the baryons plus the Newtonian potential to the dark matter. And once you look at this great big mountain of potential that's due to dark matter, you can look just at the Yukawa potential and to see how well is this Yukawa force emulating dark matter.
Right.
And in fact, you can do the same thing with Mon.
Yeah, but Mon is very well.
Oh, Mon does fit.
Mon is very different because that theory
a modified Newtonian potential.
It's not linear question.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
my question equation is linear.
Yeah, that's my puzzle. That's exactly the puzzle.
No, but there's a non-local piece.
In your theory?
No.
Because that's the point I missed. Where's the non-local piece?
Yeah.
The non-local
piece is FG or something. And
you get the...
It was your field equation.
This thing here is non-local.
That's the solution.
You always get that with the
Yukawa. That's a partial.
That's not really non-local.
Well,
if I take a delta function source for the density.
No, okay. If you take a delta function, but if you don't, you have a mass distribution. It looks non-local. It's an integral.
But that's
the real data looks very much like a smooth.
That's disease. Exactly what I get in a linear theory.
The point, this is why you don't get Gauss's law.
No, I agree. So Gauss's law is violated because it's a massive field.
You know about this.
You pointed this out last week, and that surprised me. But indeed, just a massive scalar violates Gauss's law. But still, this is a linear formula because what I'm doing is I'm calculating the force of the Yukawa field for each point mass within the density source, mm-hmm. and I'm integrating over them. So that's linear in the.
But this integral goes all the way to infinity.
Yeah, but if the density has compact support, then all I'm doing to calculate the force out here is summing up over the force between pairs of elements within the compact source. So to me that looks local. But maybe if I can look at your full covariant equations.
Because there's mu squared here in GN.
The mu depends on the mass, right? That's the thing.
We should look back. So there's a mu squared there, and then in the rho there's another mu squared.
Oh, in the rho there's a mu.
Rho is the density. So
right.
If you think data is just rho, and ideally your data would be rho, then mass is just the integral of rho. And everything can be expressed in terms of the fundamental measure.
Oh, because mu depends on mass,
and if you integrate that equation for phi to systemless increase function, you do not only integrate over the mass density, you integrate over the power, and integrate by the mass over all the points even outside of the mass. Right? And you get two volume integrals if you integrate that equation.
I haven't written down the freeze
form. Oh,
yeah, I see what you're saying. I haven't
written the freeze form. It has a Laplacian on the left hand.
It's in the paper.
I'm sorry. Okay, you're right. It is not local. But can I still look at the covariant equations?
Yep.
If that's okay. Sorry to take the time. I'm just very curious.
There's another talk.
Oh, there's another talk.
I'm not sure if it's
okay. Oh, yeah, that's it. That's the one. That's the one. That one, yes. Yeah, so there, naively, I don't see where the is. Because I see a bunch of fields, G, mu, omega, and they all have, you know, a bunch of derivatives acting on them. So the equation is
a local. It's a local.
It looks local.
The underlying theory is definitely local. Right. We thought it was a Lagrangian, it was local.
These are nonlinear equations.
They're not linear.
They're local.
I correctly determined they're local equations.
Right.
It's a covariant set.
Ben, you mentioned a number of times that you wanted to linearize these equations.
Naively, if I take r to infinity, I shouldn't take r to infinity. I know you don't like that, but whatever. Normally, why these extra terms would be irrelevant is you would say at very large distances, extra derivatives are suppressed.
Yes.
They're suppressed because they go as 1 over r, more power than 1 over r.
I think so.
So your equations would look linear in that
way.
The only term that would survive would be box G, would be box mu, would be box omega in these equations, in the limit of large R, naively.
It says 405.
Sorry?
I believe so.
Okay. All right. Well, how can we check?
Do you have any control visuals?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can talk more. Sorry. Oh, this is very interesting.
Thank you. Yeah.